give all the teachers time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. Today, we have a very special show. We are going to be live talking to Dr. Lois Wiener and her guest, Mary Compton, from London, England. This is a first for us, and maybe even a first for many shows that we'll be able to actually get into the global nature of the war on public education. As you may recall, Dr. Wiener was on our show a few weeks ago. She is a professor of education at New Jersey City University. She coordinates a master's degree program in urban education for experienced teachers. She has published widely on teacher education, school reform, teacher unionism, and is a past president of Special Interest Group on Teachers Work and Teachers Union of the American Education Research Association. She has taught high school for 15 years in California and New York and was an activist teacher union in Teachers Union. She is currently a member of the new public editorial board and maintains a website of information about the global project to deprofessionalize teaching. Lois, how are you? And how is London?
Well, London has been great because of this wonderful conference that Mary Compton, who's here with me, organized on behalf of the National Union of Teachers, the largest teachers union in Europe. Mary is herself a past president of the union, who maintains the website teachersolidarity.com. And I can't think of anyone who's more of an expert about what's going on globally in terms of the attack on public education and the resistance to it. So my time in London has been taken up with meeting with people at this conference about how we can educate teachers in the UK and teachers globally about this assault. So it's been great, Jim.
Well, welcome, Mary, and how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Jim. And like Lois, I've very much enjoyed the conference that we've been organizing here in London. And I'm very, very happy to be able to talk to you about the situation here in the UK, but also globally.
Tell us about the conference. I know it's a two-day conference. Tell us about the objective, how many people came, where did they come from, etc. Just give us a full picture of what the conference was all about.
Okay, so it was a conference which was open to members of the National Union of Teachers in the UK. We had a target of 100 members coming, and that's what we had. We had 100 members there who were activists in the union. And we also had speakers, workshop leaders from many continents. So we had somebody coming to speak from Ecuador, we had somebody from British Columbia, we had somebody from Chicago, we had somebody from India, we had somebody from Greece, and somebody from Sweden. So we had a spread of people. The only thing that was disappointing was that we'd hoped to get more voices from the Global South, but the UK immigration authorities wouldn't allow, for example, the colleague from Addis Ababa University to come into the UK. So we didn't have anybody from Ethiopia, which is what we'd been hoping. But I think the conference succeeded because its aim was it had two aims. One was to bring together researchers on these issues from different parts of the world, and the other was to let our own members in the National Union of Teachers begin to understand how far the things that they were suffering in our country, in the UK, were a global phenomenon and not just something which was a function of our incredibly reactionary education secretary, whose latest edict I read today was to ban American literature from our A-level English curriculum. So we're no longer allowed to teach To Kill a Mockingbird, Of Mice and Men, both of which have been very popular books with our people. So that's an example of what he's like. But what we were trying to get across was it's not just him, he's just a foot soldier almost, or perhaps an officer, for this same project which is affecting you in the US, perhaps more sharply even than it is affecting us.
So, did you succeed in reaching your objective in terms of making your people more aware of what's happening globally, as well as having what's happening in individual districts in England or all of England itself? That's one of the questions that I'm going to put to Lois as well, in terms of, having attended this conference, what did you get out of it, and what would I have gotten out of it had I been able to attend the conference?
Well, I'm sorry you weren't able to attend, because you would have loved it. It was so thrilling to see British teachers, who are really no different from American teachers in caring about children, and being demoralized and angry at what's happening to the profession, and to see them connecting the dots between their situation and what's going on globally. There was a great energy that came out of the conference. People were talking, the British teachers, members of NUT, were talking excitedly with one another about plans that they had about bringing the message back to their districts and back to their schools. I learned a great deal from the workshops and the papers that were presented, and we've decided to collect the papers into a booklet that we're going to, the NUT is going to publish and distribute to its own members in a print edition, but we'll have a file uploaded to the research collaborative site of teachersolidarity.com, so we can share these papers globally. Or that is with the Anglophone, in the Anglophone world. And it was just fascinating to have the opportunity to talk to with researchers who are very much informed about the neoliberal project in their own countries and the nature of resistance to it. So it was an extraordinary experience, and I'm very, very grateful that the National Union of Teachers is politically aware enough to sponsor an event like this. It's so rare to have researchers brought together with teacher union leaders and rank and file members. It was really quite thrilling to have that interaction with people.
turn the microphone, as it were, over to Mary to have her comment on what she thinks happened.
I don't think I can add much to what Lois said as far as that goes. I think she's really summed it up. And just to say that, as far as I think the feeling, I did get the feeling from our members that they were very, that it helps. It's not only is it important for us to understand so that we can express solidarity with unions and teachers in the rest of the world, but if you can understand where the assault is coming from, which is ruining your work and your professional life, then that's the first step towards being able to fight it. And I think that's something that people really, and some people were saying things like, I've never realized any of this stuff before, you know, that I think people really, I learnt a lot, and I think everybody there really learnt a lot from that conference.
That is exactly what I wanted to hear, because you and your organization are doing things on a level that we're not doing here in the U.S. And Lois, I want you and I to share something here about the fact that Mary continually mentioned the term neoliberalism and what that means and how neoliberalism is impacting public education globally as the driving force to privatize public education, to destroy teachers' unions, destroy teaching as a profession. We don't mention neoliberalism here very much. Most people don't even know what you're talking about when you say to them neoliberalism. I've had that experience on many occasions. People who are educated people, who have gone to college, who are middle class, who have kids in public schools, who themselves went to public schools, when I mention the word neoliberalism and what it's all about, they look at me with blank faces. Is that your experience, Lois? Am I right in saying that we don't see the big picture, more or less, that neoliberalism is all about?
Well, Jim, you're absolutely right about that. And it relates to the fact that it makes many people in the U.S. uncomfortable to talk about our economic system, which is capitalism. And although Forbes and Wall Street is really willing to talk about capitalism, but those of us who have objections to what capitalism is doing to public education seem reluctant to name it as capitalism. Warren Buffett's statement that this is a class war, and of course the other side is winning. But neoliberalism is a project, a stage of capitalism that has rejected the agreements that were made after the Second World War about the social safety net and about public services and about the rights of workers to organize. And it is pursuing a single-minded in education, a single-minded project to privatize. The thinking is that, in neoliberal thinking, is that the so-called free market is the best regulator of all human services, including education, and that we can have quality schools for all kids if we just get rid of these pesky things like school boards that stand in the way of the market, or teachers' unions, and that what we really need is to allow people who have the most smarts about everything, that is, people who head corporations and banks, determining public policy and educational policy. So under this model, there's really no place for parents or teachers or community to sit at a table together and determine what education should look like in their community and in their schools, because corporate leaders and billionaires are thought to be the people who know best, because after all, they're wealthy. So the Neoliberal Project globally has, and we had a wonderful presentation at the conference by Susan Robertson, who's a internationally known researcher from University of Bristol here in the UK, and she co-edits a journal called Globalization and Society, I think is the name of the journal. Really very smart, important research. But Susan's presentation outlined what has been called GERM, the Global Education Reform Movement. It consists of privatization of schooling, cutbacks in funding, standardized testing, and deprofessionalization of teaching by getting rid of teaching as a career and bringing in people who are young and working them for a few years and then having them leave. The theory is that standardized testing by itself is going to be able to account for quality control. And the other part of the project is to destroy teachers' unions because they interfere with business and business moguls doing what they want in the public sector. And that this term neoliberalism is really accepted in most of the world. And though it's a little confusing for Americans because we usually think of liberals as being pro-public service in the Franklin Roosevelt New Deal tradition, neoliberalism is something very different. And I think that we have to get with the rest of the world in understanding that this is a project of capitalism.
Lois, you have hit it, as usual, the nail on the head. I was going to say that in some of my previous shows, I've talked about neoliberalism, its genesis at the University of Chicago with Milton Friedman. In fact, when you and I talk, I think I mentioned some of this, and that you just stated that the word itself, neo meaning new, liberalism meaning, it used to mean liberal, like liberal Democrat, liberal politician, populist politician. To take the word neoliberalism and to turn it on its head was a stroke of genius in terms of propaganda, and that you say neoliberal and people go, oh yeah, that's probably a very good thing. When in fact, what it means that it's new in the sense that we want to liberalize the market. We want to deregulate the market, whatever, be it airlines, now education. We want to bring in corporate people and organizations to tell us what our problems are and how these problems can be solved, and to come in and bring their corporate style practices to whatever the problem is or the defined crisis is, and to give them basically free rein. That's what this liberalism means. They're to liberalize the environment that they're going to work in to the point where they have no government interference, regulations, restrictions, etc. And you are right in terms of the attachment of capitalism to the word neoliberalism. We here in the U.S., it's capitalism versus socialism versus communism. And so that we've been taught from birth almost over the last 40, 50, 60 years that socialism, communism are the enemies to American democracy. They don't say American capitalism, American democracy, and hence anything that smacks of communism or socialism is taboo. And so the word neoliberalism is used to sort of as an umbrella to make sure that Americans don't see what the neoliberal establishment is really out to do. I'm glad you stated it the way you did because you gave me an opportunity to get my little views in on neoliberalism. I have another question about, Mary, your organization, and also, Lois, about your organization, Teacher Solidarity and Teacher United. I'm looking at these two organizations and saying to myself, they are two sides of the same coin. Am I correct in that?
Well, I think that there is a relationship because I'll let Mary talk about TeacherSolidarity.com. Teachers Unite is an organization of social justice teachers in New York City who are committed to working with communities of color to make the schools more equitable and more just. And right now they're working on projects to end zero tolerance and end the school-to-prison pipeline. And I think that a common concern with TeacherSolidarity.com, Mary's website, is that we both feel that teachers' unions have an enormous role to play in defending social justice in the schools and in the society. And so that's really the connection between the two groups. But Jim, if you'll let me, I want to share with listeners, and I hope Mary will add to this, one of the things that we learned in Susan Robertson's presentation, because she's really doing research on the global scale, she talked about a really chilling project in Ghana, which is pay-as-you-go schooling. And students there are being given vouchers for essentially daily schooling. The money is loaded on a credit card, on a debit card, and they use this debit card to pay for packaged instruction that's provided by multinational corporations. So it's even worse than the old voucher plan of giving schools a set amount of money per student or giving that to the student's family and saying, spend it at the school that you want. Because now they're not even insisting that it be a school. It's like you could walk into a 7-Eleven or a convenience store and say, here's 20 cents or here's $5. I want lesson 1B in speaking English. It's quite shocking. And of course, this money is going to be paid for by families in user fees and probably supplemented by the government.
Can I add to that?
Yes, Mary, why don't you add to that?
This is a scheme called School in a Box, which is run by the Pearson Corporation. And it costs parents the equivalent of 60 cents a day for per child. And that is, they've calculated that not for the poorest of the poor, but for most poorer people in Ghana, that's about a third of their income, which means that they would have to choose which child to send, if they could afford to send anybody at all. And the school that they go to, in this case, is something where everything is provided for the teacher, in inverted commas, who doesn't have any agency at all and no training, and gets paid a fifth of what That's 20% of what a government teacher would be paid in Ghana. And government teachers in Ghana, I don't know the exact figure, but they get paid, I don't know, maybe $100 a month. So they don't get paid very much. So these are people who are going to be paid probably less than a dollar a day to teach these poor children. And this is a project by Pearson, which is part of a global project whereby companies like Pearson and other big corporations are making a huge amount of money by spreading these kinds of plans around the world, particularly using also using education software for testing data collection on a more regional level. So it is a very shocking situation, and what makes it so difficult is made me think when you were talking about the word liberal and how that was, that had kind of positive connotations. What makes it so difficult to fight is that corporations like Pearson and also organizations like the World Bank and also big foundations like the Gates Foundation all use the language of social justice to cover what they're doing. So they'll talk about the Millennium Development Goals, they'll talk about education for all, and really this is masking a project to provide for low-income children all over the world a very minimal offer of education, something that is quite denatured as education. So, you know, I just wanted to add to what, I haven't really said anything about the website, but I just wanted to add to what Lois was saying about this this situation in Ghana that Susan reported on.
I'm glad you did, because I hadn't picked that up yet in the literature. It's frightening, but it's also very consistent with the corporatization of public education. It's a new wrinkle that I'm sure they're testing out, and if it works, it will migrate across the pond, as you guys would say, to the U.S. and Canada and elsewhere. That's frightening. I have to say it again. That's really frightening. For our listeners, Pearson is the biggest corporate entity in e-learning, e-textbooks, development of standardized testing, scoring those tests, the bringing technology into education for profit. It is global. It is huge. It dwarfs most all of the other companies that are trying to get into the education market as entrepreneurs. And it doesn't surprise me that it is Pearson who has come up with this scheme to further be able to control public education, or I should say, to convert public education to private education using a debit card. I'll say it again. That's ugly and that's frightening. And also something that you said in terms of social justice, hijacking the language. This hijacking of civil rights language started back in the 1990s here in the U.S. And I mentioned this in one of my earlier broadcasts when I was talking about the history of public education and various social movements that have taken place over the last 100 years here in the U.S. concerning public education. And I'll just repeat briefly to amplify what you were saying, that in the 80s, 90s, there were two movements that came out of Milton Friedman's idea of how public education could be made a private enterprise through choice, and a movement developed to try and put Milton Friedman's ideas into operation. At the same time, there's another movement, the Standards Movement, Standards being like the Common Core, but of course, Common Core were not the issue at the time. Those two movements failed in their first effort. They learned from their failures, and what they did was they took the language of the civil rights movements of the 1950s, 1960s, and 70s, and co-opted those ideas, added them to their individual movement, and came out with the Standards Movement 2.0, the Choice Movement 2.0, and they connected with elements of the public. So this idea of couching their message in terms of social justice, or the famous words, the civil rights movement of our time, is nothing new. It's very clever, and it's something that they learned that would work for them by, of all things, studying the success of the civil rights movement. Which brings me to a question that, Mary, I wanted to have you respond to. And it, my question is, are they there yet? And I list a number of organizations, and you have sort of hit on them. And one was Teach for America. I know Teach for America here in the U.S. has evolved itself to the point where it is now seeking to go globally with its program. Is Teach for America there, and is it having any impact?
Yes, and Teach for America, I think the last count was in 32 countries. So you've got, obviously it's not called Teach for America. It's called Teach for China, Teach for India, Teach for
Canada.
Teach for
Spain.
Yeah, but an awful lot of these Teach Fors are in the Global South. So when I did some research in Mumbai in India, in a low-income school in a slum in Mumbai called Dharavi, which was an English medium school, which is a story in itself, that the hegemony of English around the world is, you know, as the language of aspiration, you know, low-income children going to schools where English is spoken, but they have no English at home. That's another story, and that's another, and actually that's, it also feeds into the Teach For model, because Teach for India is only done through the medium of English. But again, if you look on the Teach for India website, the way it's framed is in terms of social justice for Indian children, and along with that, attacks on a very sort of obvious attack on the teaching force that is in India at the moment, the teachers, you know, the government teachers, saying something, I can't remember exactly off the top of my head, but something like, you know, 20% of the time teachers aren't in the classroom, and when they are there, a lot of the time they're not teaching. Now, I was in this school in Dharavi. There were some Teach for America associates, as they call them, there. They were people who, without exception, had come from middle class or upper middle class families, who were highly educated, who had, you know, come out of the business world, usually banking, or were high level graduates. And there, absolutely, there was no question. When I said to them, are you going to go into teaching after this? They looked at me as though I was mad, because there was no question of them going into teaching as a profession, because teaching is so poorly paid in India that they wouldn't think about it. So this was quite clearly, as the Times of India put it, which is one of the sponsors of Teach for India, a break from a blue chip job. It's something to improve their CV, to make them more, so they either, after Teach for India, would go back into the corporate world, or very commonly, and I believe this is also the case in America, they would go into education, inverted commas, reform, and they would propagate the ideas of neoliberal education reform around India. So that was their kind of trajectory, as it were, their career trajectory. In terms of their role in the school, the teachers had very few resources. Teach for India associates had money to buy resources from the organisation. They also had things like laptops, data projectors, so that whereas the other teachers were teaching with a blackboard and a bit of chalk, if they were lucky, these people had much more high-tech stuff, and they were teaching in a very instrumentalist sort of way. So they had lots of slogans around the walls, and they had the children chant things like, you know, we are responsible leaders. There was a whole ideology going on about, you know, really turning these children into, I suppose, little neoliberal subjects who were going to, you know, change the world, although actually there was no chance of that because these children had no chance of going to secondary school, literally no chance. They went to primary school and then that was it. So you had this cadre of people from the corporate world or from the universities coming into schools to a very much in with the same sort of discourse as in Teach for America or Teach First in this country, to, as it were, show the ordinary teachers how it was done, to, you know, to bring their kind of energy and so on into this school and to change the lives of children. But of course, total illusion. The fact that it was, as I said, based only in English schools in itself speaks volumes. I mean English speaking schools. And again, you know, this language of social justice is absolutely everywhere in that teach. You just have to look on the website. It's called the global website is called Teach for All, but it's a brainchild or a spawn or whatever you want to call it of Teach for America, basically Endicott and the whole Teach for America project. So yeah, and it's here in England as well. I have to say, in England, there's slightly more Teach First people who do actually stay in teaching, because teaching isn't so badly paid, obviously, as it is in India. But again, you know, just as an anecdote, I met a young woman at a wedding who had taught for 2 years under the Teach First scheme. And I said to her, "What are you doing now?" She was, I don't know, 26 or something like that. She was now working in Detroit, telling career teachers in Detroit how they should be teaching, mentoring, you know, very experienced, presumably, teachers in Detroit from her, you know, grand position of having had 2 years experience in a school in London. So, you know, that project, it is global, and, you know, it is, I find, it's a very typical example of what we're talking about.
Well, do you also have what we have here, Broad Academies, where Eli Broad, the billionaire philanthropist, supposedly, set up these academies to train people to become principals, superintendents, and go into public school districts and eventually take over said districts? Do you have anything like that? And another one, are you familiar with Alex here? The American Legislative Exchange group here, Common Core. I know you guys have our equivalent of charter schools. And I guess lastly, how about school closing and school turnarounds, closing public schools and then turn around and giving them to private entities? Are any of those things happening there in England and across Europe, Asia, Africa? As far as you know?
Yeah, I don't know of anything quite so blatant as Alec. I'm getting pretty cynical, but even I'm kind of amazed by that organisation. I think it's much more subtle in the UK. I think the sort of class, you know, the class connections, the old school tie, the revolving door around politics and then into finance and so on is all there. But the actual, you know, people actually writing legislation and you know, that in that quite that blatant form that you can read about it on a website doesn't happen. We're much more subtle over here. It happens, but it's not so blatant. In terms of leadership academies, again, in this country, you have something called the National Professional Qualification for Headship, which tends to, which all heads now have to do, which very much promotes the managerial agenda and sees heads as managers and so on. But it's not run by a foundation. It's at present, it's run by the government. But we do have in this country things called academies, which are like charter schools, and free schools, which are like charter schools as well, but more extreme, where any group of people, religious fanatics, whatever, can run a school, can more or less promote their own curriculum and can set their own paying conditions and can also hire, don't have to hire any qualified teachers, so they can have completely unqualified teachers if they want to. And that the education sector is trying to stop them from being inspected. So that's, you know, so that's going on in this country. In terms of the rest of the world, I mean, in India, for example, there's a huge spread of what they call low-fee private schools, which is private schools for the very poor, which is a bit like what Lois was talking about in Ghana. They're very prevalent all across India. These are schools which, you know, can be very, very badly resourced, but parents have to pay for them, and they're run by sometimes private individuals, quite often politicians own a chain of schools, or by corporations. So, for instance, James Tooley, who's one of the arch neoliberal education theorists, also himself is involved in running chains of private schools in the Global South. So these things, this privatisation agenda is absolutely, well, almost completely global. Obviously, there are some countries which doesn't affect, but which is, I can't remember what the other thing was that you asked me, but those are three of the things. Anyway, I can't remember what
they're. Well, they're having a curriculum battle. You know, I would answer this, that in much of the Global South, when the economies, when people wanted loans from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the international agencies demanded that the countries modernize, and that was in quotation marks, their educational system. And what modernization means for the World Bank and the IMF is that the countries buy materials that are produced by the multinational corporations. Oftentimes, materials that are completely inappropriate for their students in terms of language and content. So they have, in effect, a common core dictated by the multinational corporations, because they've been forced to buy these curriculum materials as part of their modernization of education. And one of the people who was at the conference told a really chilling story about his work. He's done a lot of work in Africa. And the story he told was of what he called plasma education, that instruction was transmitted from one country in Africa, from South Africa to Ethiopia, and students were just put in front of this big plasma TV, and they were given instruction in the subject matter all day. That's what education consisted of. And what made it worse is that the accents of the people providing the instruction in South Africa were not intelligible to the students in Ethiopia. So, I mean, it's not even that students are being educated to a low level. It's that they're not being educated at all. And yet they're paying money. They're charged user fees.
and governments that had very scarce resources to spend on education are spending it on these fraudulent schemes. It's really snake oil.
Can I give you another example of that? There's a scheme in Kenya called Laptops for Schools, which has been, the Gates Foundation's provided some of the backing for that in terms of training and so on. And the Kenyan government has been persuaded, I don't know how, but has been persuaded to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on buying laptops for schools. And there's a huge kick. There were teacher strikes about this in Kenya because they were buying these laptops under conditions where there was a massive, and still is, a massive shortage of teachers. And they were holding up banners saying things like, we need teachers, not laptops. But this was made worse by the fact that the children themselves were going to be, each child was going to be responsible for his or her own laptop, and their family would be responsible. And if anything happened to the laptop, then they would be liable for this laptop. And this is under conditions where a lot of these schools, a lot of schools in the Global South have no sanitary facilities, no toilets. Some of them don't even have buildings, literally. And often no electricity, which is another problem with the Ethiopian example that Lois was talking about, that in many of the schools there wasn't even any electricity, so they were given generators, and of course they broke down, So these kind of, it'd be ridiculous if it wasn't so shocking and so immoral, really. So instead of what the World Bank is always emphasising is, we're not interested in inputs, we're interested in outputs. Well, what they mean by that is, we don't want to, pay teachers more money. We don't want to provide more money for classrooms. What we want is to get results. And so, it's a truly shocking situation. And I think it's the same. The things that are faced by teachers in the US and in my country, in England and Wales, it's all coming from the same thing. There's no money provided for education, or there's not enough money provided. And yet, there's this endless accountability about what we produce in the way of, in inverted commas, results.
Now, people were comparing the laptop for Kenya to the LA Unified School District's buying all these iPads. The fiasco of buying the iPads for the students, spending all that money, the latest scandal with BZ and the whole laptop
spending
fiasco.
Projected over $1 billion and growing. And in a district where we need buildings need to be repaired, the money comes out of a bond issue that was supposedly going to repair old schools, modernize them, build new schools, and our superintendent was able to work around that and commit over $1 billion, and I say, and climbing, in buying iPads from Apple. And Pearson providing software. It is a mess, but it's part of the political process. Mary mentioned the International Monetary Fund and how it uses its clout to make developing countries jump through certain kinds of hoops in order to get money from the international community. Well, here we are jumping through hoops to allow Pearson, Apple, and other such companies come in and take our very precious resources in terms of money out of the purpose for which they were supposed to be used. I have one more question in this vein. Do you guys have in England and Europe our equivalent to a Michelle Rhee and people like her with the face and the voice of school privatization?
Hmm. It's a,
Well, let me, before Mary answers that, I just want to say that one of the most exciting workshops in this conference was given by an officer of the Chicago Teachers Union. So what's really, from a research point of view, what's fascinating is that there's no country where, is that at the same time that we have these incursions that are terrible, we also have resistance that is making a difference. And it's very important, I think, that we understand that while the United States is exporting Teach for America, we're also exporting the knowledge and the success of the Chicago Teachers Union, which really electrified teachers throughout the world, because that was a media event. And they were energized and buoyed and educated by what Chicago teachers did in facing down Rahm Emanuel, which is really facing down the White House. So I just want to make that point, Jim, that it's not a story just of incursion of the corporations. It's also a story of a growing resistance to what they're doing. And now I'm going to have, Mary was going to say something about Michelle Rhee.
I don't know what to say about Michelle Rhee, really. I don't think we have, actually. I'll probably think as soon as this program's over, oh, yes, it's, but I can't think of anybody quite like her, no. But in if I could just take up what Lois was just saying, that the resistance, again, is global. I mean, I you know, as you know, I run this website. And there isn't, you know, there aren't ever 2 days go by without there being a strike of teachers somewhere in the world. So, for example, tomorrow, the British Columbian Teachers Union will be on a series of rolling strikes. And unless there's an agreement at midnight, the Norwegian teachers will be on strike tomorrow. But this is in no way confined to the North. Teachers across Africa, Kenya, teachers in Kenya have had, you know, have had weeks of strikes over things like contract teachers, Nigeria. I mean, I could just name any country in the world, really, that teachers are in a continuous struggle against. Often it takes the form of struggling for pay, because I can't tell you how bad the conditions are for teachers in the global South. However bad you imagined it was, it's worse. It's dreadful. It's many teachers in the South can't afford to live at all on the salaries they get and have to have extra jobs just in order to keep themselves alive, basically. Teachers in, I mean, while the awful thing has been happening in the north of Nigeria with the girls being abducted, what nobody talks about is the fact that 173 teachers have also been killed by Boko Haram. The Nigerian teachers were on strike this week about that very issue. And in another part of Nigeria, in a state called Benue State, the teachers have been on strike for months for the minimum wage, and some of those teachers have literally starved to death in the fight for a minimum wage. So, you know, the conditions for teachers are appalling, but all over the world, teachers are fighting back. And if you want to, Chicago indeed is very inspirational, but if you want to look towards the South, some of the most inspirational struggles are in Latin America. So the Mexican teachers who've been involved in a hugely complex and subtle dispute over evaluation, which is very much complicated by the corruption in the official teachers union CENTE, which has made it much more difficult for people to understand who haven't really been following it carefully. But the Mexican teachers working with communities, working with indigenous communities, and fighting for a vision of education, you know, a critical vision of education, is very, very inspiring. And that's another reason, really, for this conference we just had and for the website, is so that teachers can learn from one another, so that we don't have this idea that somehow we in the North are against privatization, against testing and so on, and that teachers in the South just need a bit of charity to, you know, to help them. That's not it at all. We need to learn from each other, learn, develop solidarity, but also develop knowledge from one another about how to resist and what's going on. So, as Lois says, it's not just negative. There's a lot of, you know, it's time. the forces of neoliberalism are global. There's no doubt about that. They understand, they absolutely get that it's a global world we're living in, and they're making the most of it. We have to respond globally. We have to understand that it's global, and we have to join together with one another and fight these forces, and not only to resist, but also, as the Mexican teachers are doing, and our Chicago teachers did as well with their document, The Schools Our Children Deserve, to say, this is the kind of schooling we want to develop, a new kind of schooling. Not go back to the what was there in the past, because a lot of that wasn't very good either. What we're saying is we need to build schooling that's really emancipatory. It's really about a shared experience of learning together, of learning about what democracy is, why the world is constituted in the way it is, and how we can construct a better world, how we can show children, with children, with communities, to see that another world is possible. This is what we should be doing. It is a message of hope, but it is a gargantuan struggle.
Well, you have just said everything that I was going to say in my closing. The message that I wanted show to put forth was, we are all in it together. Be it if you're in Africa, you're in Latin America, you're in the United States, you're in Northern Europe, you're in a small rural community here in the South, etc. We are all in this war together. And you've done a very good job of stating that. The last part that I also wanted to talk about, but we don't have time now because I know both of you have to go back to the conference, and that is, I wanted to talk about the resistance, what I call the rising resistance to corporate efforts to take over public education on a global basis. And you have touched on many areas where the resistance is alive and well. You've touched on how what happened in Chicago in 2012 became so inspirational for other teachers in different parts of the world, and et cetera. I would like to, this show was part of a series that Hope Mary and I and others will do pertaining to both the corporate war and the rising resistance to that war. And hopefully in the future I'll be able to go more in depth to the resistance movement as it is portrayed across the globe, and to also use our show as further inspiration to others to join in the resistance or to start their own resistance movement. And I think to some extent we were able to do a little of that today. And in parting, there's one thing I want you and everyone listening to really understand. It is estimated that the global education market is $7 trillion and growing. And that my view is that from the very beginning, the corporate invasion into public education was inspired by the fact that there is this enormous amount of money that they can get their hands on. And they went at it in such a way that from a military standpoint, brilliant in developing strategy, ranging from the propaganda to lay it out first so that when they made their assault, the public would be on their side, to bringing in politicians, buying politicians here in the U.S. from the president all the way down to the Congress, the Senate, the court, governors, state legislatures, bringing in communities, the African-American community, the Hispanic community, other poor communities in terms of bringing them into the charter school system, and et cetera. This, to me, was a very concerted, clever plan that they developed into an agenda that was aimed for the global ed community that we've been talking about. And it was all, in my view, driven by trying to get their hands on the $7 trillion rainbow. Now, I know you ladies have to go, and I could continue to talk to you for another hour. Mary, be safe and get back home. I should say Lois, be safe and get back home. Mary, I would hope to talk to you and your organization again and again and again. I do subscribe to your website. I get a lot of my understanding of what's happening globally from your work, and I would love to be able to report to the world what is going on via what I'm getting from your website and the research that you and your people are doing. In other words, I hope to develop a relationship with you guys that will allow me to, on a regular basis, inform the world about what's happening globally in this war of public education. Ladies, I will give you the last word. Anything you would like to say in summing it up before you leave?
I think you summed it up for me, Jim. Thank you very much for having us on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was really good to talk to you, and looking forward to talking to you again.
Okay. Be safe and have a good adventure, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.
Good God, y'all.
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Let's
say it again.